Here are the numbers right now. Wind is from the northeast at 10. 50 degrees Racine, 53 Kenosha, 49 for Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for WGTD's morning show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenoshans who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Mr. Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago and later served as station manager and occasional morning show co-host. And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. In part one of today's program, we're going to be continuing the conversation begun on yesterday's program about the book Vanishing Frontiers, examining the rich and complicated relationship between the United States and Mexico and where that relationship might be headed. In part two of today's program, we will remember Robert F. Kennedy. Stay with us.
Okay.
And in this part of the morning show, I am continuing my conversation with Andrew Seeley about his incredible book, Vanishing Frontiers, The Forces Driving Mexico and the United States Together. Mr. Seeley, I appreciate you making even a little more time available to me. You've already been very generous, and I just want to make sure our listeners understand how much your book covers. And I want to ask you, how exhausting was it to write this book and to try to cover all of the bases as thoroughly as you do?
It took a bit of time and a bit of effort because I was writing about things that I know really well, and I was writing about things that I don't know as well, actually, that I had to get to know. I spent a lot of time learning about, film and tech innovation, for example, which I really hadn't spent time on, and spent time in cities I hadn't spent in the United States and in Mexico I hadn't spent time in. So it was a lot of fun, but there was a lot of, I frankly learned a lot along the way.
I want to make sure that we talk about a really interesting issue that you raise in the chapter of the book about security. And the story that really is the touchstone for this chapter is Hurricane Katrina in the fall of 2005. And this is a really important moment in terms of relations between the two countries, but a moment that is largely forgotten. Not that Katrina is forgotten, but this amazing gesture from the Mexican government, I think, is largely forgotten. Explain to our listeners what I am talking about.
Yeah, in the middle of Hurricane Katrina, the Mexican government decides that it's going to send aid to the United States. And this is, this is 2005. So this is before Mexico and the U.S. have had much of a security relationship. The military in Mexico really distrusts the military in the U.S. Mexico has been willing to talk trade, but they don't want to talk about, they don't want to really go far beyond that. And they decide that they're going to send aid, and the ones to do it is the Mexican Navy. And so the story starts actually with the chargé d'affaires at the U.S. Embassy. The guy who's in charge of the U.S. Embassy at the moment gets a phone call from his counterpart of the Foreign Ministry of Mexico saying, "We'd like to send aid." And he says, "Thank you, that's great. I'll, run that up through the channels. How kind." And his counterpart sort of pauses and says, "They're actually on their way. We have the Mexican Navy on its way to the border. And they're carrying aid, and we've got food, and they've got water, and they've got medical facilities, and they'll be ready to go. Tell them where to go." And it's fairly complicated because actually the U.S. has just turned back a plane from Germany because it hadn't gone through the right procedures, and there's a whole bureaucratic procedure here. And the U.S. government actually pulls it off. I mean, they have about 24 hours, if I remember correctly, to figure out how they're going to do this. And it gets pulled off in large part because the U.S. military, not just the State Department, but the U.S. military says this is our opportunity to build a relationship with the Mexican military. This is, you know, people at the White House get the fact that this is an opportunity to build a different kind of relationship with Mexico. And it's also, you know, a moment where Mexico gets to show strength. Mexico's always been the junior partner in this relationship. And here Mexico gets to be helpful to the United States. And so they make it work out. The Mexican, actually, this is the Mexican Army, not the Navy. The Navy actually goes the following week. The Mexican Army makes it to the border, and they allow them through. They actually work out all the details so they can go through. I don't think I put this in the book, but they actually take away the meat because it doesn't pass. But they don't take away the meat till it gets to San Antonio. And so in San Antonio, they actually get more meat donated from a supermarket chain. And they end up, actually, there are pictures, you know, in newspapers across the United States and in newspapers in Mexico about this. And for Mexico, it really becomes a touch point where Mexicans realize that they're able to do something for the United States. And this is a two-way relationship. And on things as sensitive as security and military cooperation, we can actually talk to each other. And it becomes a real opening point. It becomes really important down the road as drug trafficking organizations begin to terrorize both countries, and they need to talk about these things.
Right. You write, the goodwill built by the cooperation after Katrina would become particularly important in the coming years because the challenges were about to get much bigger and would require a shift in thinking on both sides of the border. What you are touching on is the rampant corruption and horrific violence that has also been a very unfortunate characteristic of much of Mexico, and in particular the presence of organized crime. Just sketch for us this situation in Mexico, how serious it has been, before we talk about some of these more recent efforts to combat it, which have involved cooperation between Mexico and the United States.
Well, you know, Mexico has long had a very weak judicial system and very, you know, weak police forces, and an expectation that police forces, you know, would get bribes in order to supplement their salary. And it was kind of functional. It was never good. You know, people would grouse about it. It was often unfair, but it was somewhat functional until Mexican drug cartels, which were mostly marijuana dealers, I mean, sort of small-time thugs, started getting the cocaine business. As the Colombian cartels got weaker in the 1990s and late 80s and 90s, they began transporting more and more cocaine out of Colombia and to, you know, get to the U.S. market. Because you had U.S. consumers of cocaine, and at a time when cocaine use was going up in the United States, primarily crack cocaine, but also cocaine generally, and freebase cocaine, but also all sorts of cocaine. So the Mexican cartels get into this business. They become big, big business, and they begin to then take over police forces. They begin to corrupt the judicial system, and they become incredibly powerful, terrorize mayors in local cities. You know, they're not taking over territory in the sense that they don't want to run governments. They're not interested in that. But they're interested in making sure the police don't stop them, that mayors don't get tough with them, and the governors don't get tough, and start really corrupting the system. And it's not that the system was pure before. There was a lot of corruption in Mexico. But it takes corruption to a whole new level, and it makes these groups able to operate with real impunity throughout Mexico. And then they get into, as the meth becomes a big thing, the United, meth really is produced in the United States initially, but they start picking up some of the meth production in Mexico as well, realizing they use the same routes to do that. And then more recently, they've gotten into heroin, as heroin has become a bigger – heroin was really a niche drug in the United States for many years. It's now become much more widespread, as we know. It's become a real epidemic. And so they've really moved into heroin in a way that they hadn't before. And it, you know, it had always been sort of a side business, actually, for the cartels. Now it's become a central business for them. So it is both the story of our consumption patterns in the United States driving this, but also the really weak institutions in Mexico and the fact that corruption was already there and could be really scaled up.
Hmm. So explain this special initiative. I think it's called the Merida Initiative that you talk about in the book that has been put together to try and make a meaningful difference in all of this.
Yeah, the U.S. and Mexico begin talking about a way of dealing with organized crime. And the Mexican government's idea, this is Mexican President Calderon, Felipe Calderon, is elected in 2006. And he comes to office, and he has actually no interest in dealing. I remember talking to him during the transition period, and drugs were not very high on his radar screen. But somewhere during the transition period, they begin to realize how penetrated the Mexican government is, and certainly local government, state and local governments are penetrated by these drug cartels and how much they have people on the take. And they become terrified by this. And one of the states where it's big is his home state of Michoacán, which has a new, very violent drug cartel, and so it's very personal for him. And he realizes this is a big deal. And so he comes into his first Oval Office visit with President Bush, and he basically starts telling – there's actually a great story in there where he tells President Bush what a big deal this is, the fact that the U.S. and Mexico are tied by this, that these drugs are going to American consumers. This is driven by American demand for drugs, but we're also responsible as Mexicans, which, you know, Mexicans had often sort of blamed the U.S. and said, it's all about your consumption, it's not our problem. Basically, this is our problem because we really don't have the right institutions, we haven't built up our police, our courts aren't working, we need to do something about this, we need your help, and we need to do this together. And the great story is he actually says at one point, President Bush asks him, and according to someone who is in the room, to the ambassador, the Ambassador Tony Garza, President Bush's ambassador in Mexico, says, President Bush says, what do you need? And he says, if Jack Bauer's got it, I want it. You know, it's sort of the you know, 24, for those that remember that show. You know, we really need to scale up our equipment. And so the two governments begin talking about how to help Mexico both, you know, scale up its ability to go after organized crime, which really becomes sharing intelligence, sharing information on these traffickers that are moving across the border between the two countries. You know, how do we go after them? But also it becomes, how do we build up the court system and the police? And how do we do vetting? And how do we make sure that we don't have as much corruption? It sort of begins a cycle that continues to today, much more quietly, but continues to this day of the two countries working together to see how you really limit these organized crime groups and their reach and the damage that they can do.
Right. I want to just step back for 1 second. At the end of this chapter, which begins with Katrina, but then goes into this other area that we've just now been talking about. You talk about in 2005, when Katrina created the first opening for the security agencies of the two countries to engage with each other by breaking some of the taboos of the past. Can you just explain what those taboos of the past were?
You know, they didn't talk. Mexicans, in the same way that Americans worry about, you know, poverty and immigration and low wages in Mexico, you know, Mexicans worry about the U.S. telling them what to do, you know, and really being the overbearing partner. And there's nowhere more sensitive than in security, you know. So in the military and police, judicial system, Mexico had never wanted the U.S. to get involved in those issues. And Katrina, what it did is it broke those taboos. It created a real conversation between the security establishment and the military in Mexico and in the U.S. And in a way that Mexico was in the driver's seat. Mexico had helped us, actually. And so it created this virtuous cycle where they began talking to each other and there began to be channels of communication. And so as, you know, President Calderon and President Bush identify this problem and say, we're going to work on this together, there's suddenly the ability to step in and say, okay, we're going to actually share intelligence about drug traffickers. I mean, we've got, you know, the U.S. actually lots of, for example, you know, telephone intercepts on much of the way that the Mexico's gone after drug traffickers is, you know, tracking them through their cell phones until they're able to locate them, you know, through their aide cell phones until they're able to get the cell phone of the actual leader of the cartel or the leader of the unit within the cartel and then go after them. And frankly, a lot of that signal intelligence comes from the United States, comes from U.S. agencies. So they were suddenly able to talk about, you know, it wasn't that the U.S. was going to operate in Mexico or Mexico in the U.S., though there's a little bit of that, actually. I mean, I talk about that in the book. There are actually some Mexican agents in the U.S. and U.S. agents in Mexico. But a lot of it is just beginning to share information in ways that they could not have really done before. It just would have been off the table.
Right. And you write, on the ground, the story of the past decade has been one of intense and often unseen cooperation across the border. It showed that even on the most difficult and sensitive of issues, Americans and Mexicans have been able to find common ground and develop close forms that go of cooperation that go far beyond the preconceptions that they once had of each other.
Yeah, it really is amazing. I mean, I had the privilege of talking to a lot of folks in law enforcement and intelligence agencies that have been involved in this. You know, and it's a mixed story in the end. I mean, I come down at the end saying that we did a lot together to go after the biggest groups. You don't have the same big groups you did 10 years ago anymore in Mexico. On the other hand, the same flow of drugs still exists. I mean, it's sort of changed. There's less cocaine, more heroin these days. But, you know, and you still have a lot of violence in Mexico. So it's not that they've necessarily – they've succeeded in some ways and not in other ways. There's a little less in the way of kidnappings in most of Mexico, and certainly a lot of cities are better off than they were before. I mean, there's killings among traffickers. There's less of civilians, which is a good thing, I mean, in the end. So, but it's not a clear story of enormous success, but it is a story of progress. But the fascinating thing on the ground is talking to law enforcement and intelligence officers and people in the military of the two countries who've worked together, and the enormous respect on both sides towards each other, and the ways, once you get beyond the politics, once you get beyond the politicians, how much they actually respect each other and how much they've been forged in combat together. I mean, they've been dealing with organized crime groups that are threatening their lives, and they've worked together, and they've shared information, and they've, you know, it's been used well by both sides, and it creates a virtuous circle. And the same thing is true, by the way, of judges and attorneys and others. There's been a lot of training of Mexican judges and attorneys and police in the United States. And there's a lot of mutual respect that goes back and forth with people who've been involved in those efforts, and a lot of things that continue. And that's independent of where their politicians pay attention to it or not, and whether, you know, what President Trump says about Mexico or what the incoming president of Mexico, you know, thinks about the United States, or the current president of Mexico actually was very skeptical of the U.S. when he came in, what he thinks about. You know, these are questions that really are in only the way they can happen when people are doing life and death work together, those kind of bonds that get forged.
Mm. We're speaking with Andrew Seeley about his book, Vanishing Frontiers, The Forces Driving Mexico and the United States Together. Two other matters that I want us to touch on briefly. One of them, of course, is really central to so much of this. It's about immigrants and the way in which the influx of Mexican immigrants into the United States has an effect, as does the influx, much more limited, of Americans into Mexico. And it is a very interesting and complicated situation that you are exploring. I think among the most important questions is to talk about why the numbers have changed so dramatically in recent years. That is, why the number of immigrants from Mexico to the United States have declined, even before the election of Donald Trump as president. What's going on
there? It's fascinating. Since 2007, the number of Mexicans in the U.S. has been stable, and the number of unauthorized Mexicans in the U.S., people who don't have legal documents, has actually gone down by about a million. So, I mean, there really is a drop in the unauthorized population. Some people become legalized, but a lot of people started going back, actually. You know, and some people do get legalized along. Some people who are unauthorized are waiting for visas, you know, and so eventually they become legalized. But there aren't many Mexicans that try to cross the border illegally anymore. There's a lot of Central Americans. There's a new set of issues about how Mexico and the U.S. deal with Central American flows together, because that's most of the people trying to cross the border these days. But even those are smaller flows than we once saw from Mexico. I mean, because Central American countries are small and they're far away. And, you know, so the border actually has a lot fewer, despite what we may see, you know, in political rhetoric. There just aren't that many people compared to what there used to be trying to cross the U.S.-Mexico border illegally. So, and why is hard to tell. I mean, I suspect that the reason is, and what I say in the book is, you know, I think that long-term Mexico, life in Mexico has improved. And it's hard for average Mexicans to see, because it's sort of like watching paint dry, right? If you leave the room and come back 2 hours later, it looks beautiful. If you stand there and watch the paint dry, it's agonizing. And people in Mexico have seen the country change very slowly, and so they're always frustrated about it. But if you step away and come back, what you see is that Mexicans are, you know, a third more educated than they were. They're much more, three times as likely to go to college today. They are, you know, have 4 years more life expectancy because they have much better health care. There are, you know, modern roads everywhere, which didn't exist. Overall, and incomes are about a third higher than they were 20 years ago. So, you know, it's not huge. It's not just incomes, though. I mean, incomes, you know, this is not sort of South Korean massive growth. This is, or Singapore. This is a slow growth, but with lots of other things like education, healthcare, and infrastructure that have built up. And so people's chances, you know, the chance of having a good life in Mexico has just gone up for most people. And fewer people are willing to try and risk crossing the border when they have a chance in Mexico. And conversely, what you've had is, and you've had a lot of Mexicans coming back as well, because they take the money they've earned in the U.S. and invested in Mexico and come back. And you're starting to see lots of Americans. I mean, today I think it's fair to say that they're probably, you know, the number of Americans in Mexico keeps going up and the number of Mexicans in the U.S. doesn't, which is fascinating. I mean, there's sort of more Americans moving to Mexico these days. And some of them are children of Mexicans who are going back with them. A lot of them are minors going back with Mexican parents. But a lot of them are retirees. A lot of them are people who have remote working jobs. I met a lot of people on the way, actually, in American communities who had the kind of mobile jobs. They were, you know, web designers and editors. And one person was a lawyer who did trainings by video. I mean, writers. I met a couple writers. People who have jobs who are still active in the U.S., but they just have a great quality of life in Mexico. It's a lot cheaper to live there. They live very well. They have all the amenities of life. And that wouldn't have been true 20 years ago. I mean, Mexican cities are much better to live in. And so for them, they can live a really quality life in Mexico better than they could in the U.S., and they go back when they need to.
And, of course, you point out another difference, which is that there is a significant influx of people from Central America who are trying to make their way to the United States and, of course, pass through Mexico. And this puts the nation of Mexico in a different situation and sometimes an uncomfortable situation.
Yes, this is it's a complicated. As the Mexican flows stopped, you know, and I think the other thing that stopped the Mexican flows was the U.S. economic crisis. It was kind of the tipping point that got people to stop, and then they just decided not to go again. But starting in 2014, you see a lot of Central Americans going. And the detonator there, the tipping point, is probably a rise in violence in El Salvador and Honduras. But a lot of it's about poverty as well. You know, it's both about violence and poverty, and parts of Guatemala that are both poor and violent. And these folks have been coming through. These are the folks that, you know, the caravan that President Trump was tweeting about. They are, you know, much smaller numbers than what we saw with Mexicans, you know, 15 years ago. But the number has gone up since 2014. It comes and goes depending on the year. And Mexico has started deporting people. Mexico, for the first time, has actually started detaining and deporting people. And they detain and deport almost as many people as the U.S. does, actually, back to Central America. And it's really uncomfortable for Mexicans because they still see themselves in those Central Americans. They still see themselves as part of, you know, as a migrant society. Even though they're not necessarily leaving, everyone knows a family member or a friend that moved to the United States at some point. And so when they see Central Americans coming through, they're sympathetic. And at the same time, they know they need to control their border, and they don't want a crisis with the U.S. And so they have started trying to control their border as well. But there's a huge tension. The U.S. wants them to deport everyone they can catch, and they, you know, are ramping it up, but at the same time, there's not a lot of public support for doing that.
I want us to end by talking about some of the extraordinary ways in which Mexico and the United States have, in a sense, a blurring border when it comes to cultural matters like film, television, professional sports, cuisine, even politics, in which there has been all kinds of cross-pollination in ways that we might not be at all familiar with. And I know that one of the things that must fascinate you especially is the whole area of filmmaking, and for that matter, even attending movies. I mean, there's some really interesting dynamics going on there.
It's fascinating. I mean, you know, this was an area. I mean, these are the things that I really had fun researching that, you know, you don't always get to do. So I got to watch a lot of films. I got to go eat Mexican food and call it research, and you know, it was a lot of fun. I got to take my wife on food tasting trips. So it was very nice. But the reality is there's so much cultural interpenetration, and this is really, I think, where the rubber meets the road for many Americans and many Mexicans, right? I mean, the politicians can talk about whatever they want, but increasingly we're just familiar with each other because, you know, the two cultures touch each other in so many ways. So the filmmaking industries, I mean, have gotten really close. You know, I mentioned earlier that, you know, four or five Oscar-winning directors have been Mexican in the last 5 years. I mean, there are three directors, one got it twice. You know, you can see how integrated the Hollywood scenes are. But there's a great, actually, quote from Salma Hayek. Actually, Salma, this was from an evening program. I didn't actually get to interview her. But she says she went to Cannes Film Festival, the most prestigious film festival. She says about a tenth of the people there, she said, are from Latin America, and most are Mexican, and most are my friends. And she says she gets so excited that she holds a spontaneous mariachi party, and she goes and gets all the tequila and mezcal she can, you know, in the south of France. And there are some great scenes. I actually went online and spent a few hours looking at the tape from this, because, you know, get a bunch of filmmakers together, they're going to film it. There's this spontaneous mariachi party at the Cannes Film Festival because so many of the people there are actually Mexican. And it tells you how good the Mexican film industry has become, but also because it's close to Hollywood, there's a lot of back and forth constantly between Mexican and American filmmakers, Mexican and American actors, and increasingly we have a U.S. film industry and U.S. television that's also trying to appeal to people of Latin American descent in the United States. And so they're calling on Mexican actors to come up and act in movies and on television in the United States in ways that wouldn't have happened before. And so there's a real penetration going back and forth. And then there's food. I mean, food is phenomenal, actually. I mean, you know, it's the Americans, I think it's after Italian cuisine, Mexican is the most eaten ethnic cuisine in the U.S., but there's also this high cuisine movement of Mexican food in Mexico and then in the United States. I have an interview with a young chef who's in her, she's probably 28 right now, she was 26 or 27 when I interviewed her, who runs one of the, you know, top restaurants in New York, and it's a Mexican high cuisine restaurant, but it's one of several in the United States, actually, that is, you know, recognized as sort of a top restaurant. And no one would have thought 20 years ago that Mexican food was high-class food. This was sort of, you know, peasant food. It's the kind of thing you know, you ate at home. You have a taco night. That's what I grew up with, right? You have a taco night at home with these hard tacos. And now there's sort of this whole movement around by Mexicans and by American chefs around making Mexican, you know, really high-class Mexican food. And you know, these are fascinating ways. And then you've got, you know, the food truck, the Korean barbecue tacos, right? I mean, you know, you can tell a food, you can tell that the taco has really become, the tortilla has really become American when Korean ethnic food uses the taco as an American symbol, right? And, you know, you get the Korean barbecue taco is an American food.
How about this whole arena of athletics, which has been significant and which leads you to make, it seems to me, some of your strongest statements about what you call the timeless truths of immigration in the United States in terms of the dramatic difference that immigrants make in who we are and in a sense, what we value.
You know, the fascinating thing has been to see, you know, in the past 2 years, right as we're having this tough debate about whether we should build a wall on the border with Mexico or withdraw from NAFTA, that the world of sports has gone the opposite direction. And for them, it's just been obvious that you know, consumers of audiences of Mexican descent in the United States matter, and they've really invested in that. And I have an interview with the NFL's senior marketing director about the outreach to Latinos in the U.S., and including how they use sort of Mexican symbols and Spanish language. But also south of the border, trying to reach out to the market south of the border. So you have the NBA played 4 games last year in Mexico. Just in May, actually, you had the Major League Baseball played a series in Monterrey, Mexico. Not actually in Mexico City, but in the city of Monterrey, the third biggest city. They had the Dodgers and the San Diego Padres playing 3 games. Football has, you know, NFL actually has played games the last 2 years, and they have 4 more years to go. They have a 6-year commitment to play at least 1 game a year in Mexico City. And their highest, actually, attendance ever for a game was in Mexico City. It actually broke the record of any U.S. game. So, you know, all these sports, golf played a couple tournaments last year, you know, the PGA Tour in Mexico. Even in NASCAR, which you wouldn't think necessarily as being, you know, a Mexican sport, one of the top drivers, a guy named Daniel Suarez, is actually Mexican. So, you know, and he became hooked on NASCAR when he was living in Mexico. His father sold his auto repair shop so that he could actually become a racer and move to the United States. And he was able to actually, with his success in NASCAR, go back and buy his dad a new car repair shop. So his dad's back in business again.
Amazing. Can you just say a quick word, since we have a lot of Chicago Cubs fans in our audience, about the Chicago Cubs manager, Joe Maddon? This is an interesting story.
Joe Maddon is fabulous. Joe Maddon is from Hazleton, Pennsylvania, where I start the book. And Joe has really gone back and tried to build bridges in Hazleton. He went back one Christmas and discovered that there was a lot of tension around immigration in his hometown and said, this is strange. He actually ended up going to being invited by his cousin. His cousin has been very active in building bridges between immigrants and old-time residents of Hazleton. And she invited him to a dinner at one of the Latin, you know, immigrant families the next night and said, come see for yourself. And he walked away and said, wow, this is just like our Italian family when we were growing up. You know, you got two languages going on. You have three or four generations together in the same room. Children are running around. Adults are drinking beer. I mean, it's sort of the, you know, this is how we grew up. And Hazleton was very much an Italian and Irish and Eastern European immigrant city. I mean, really, and it still has that imprint. And he said, look, these folks have come from Mexico and Dominican Republic and other parts in Latin America to renew the town the way that our grandparents came from the old world. And this is, you know, us coming back again. And so he has started something called the Hazleton Integration Project with his cousin or husband, and they have been very influential in trying to build bridges between newcomers and old-timers in the city, getting people to talk to each other and providing some real practical activities for kids after school as well. They built a community center and have been really good about reaching out to youth in the city. And so he's a hometown hero. And so I start the book actually with him and others in Hazleton, and I end the book actually with a guy named Jeff Lunau, who's not quite at the end, but he's in the conclusion, who's the Houston Astros general manager, who actually won the World Series last year. Then Joe Maddon won it the year before. And Jeff Lunau actually is great because, you know, despite his name, he actually was born and raised in Mexico. Child of American parents. And you know, his parents fell in love with Mexico, raised their children there. Their children were born there, raised there. His brother's interviewed in one of the chapters. Actually, his brother's a Wall Street Journal correspondent in Mexico. And, you know, here you have someone who's from the other side. Well, Joe Maddon is the American trying to build bridges around immigration in the U.S., and then Jeff Lunau is the son of American immigrants to Mexico, the other side of the immigration picture.
Hmm. Your book ends, of course, with some thoughts on where all of this might possibly be going. And as we close, I want to highlight one statistic that you cite, something to the effect that one of the sharpest differences you see in terms of Americans' attitudes towards Mexico and Mexicans is between ages. That, in a sense, the younger you are, the more likely you are to have a positive view of Mexico.
I think that's right. And it's true the other way in Mexico as well towards the United States. And it's because I still think for those of us that grew up at an earlier time, Mexico is still new. For the younger generations, people in their 20s and 30s, you know, the connection between our countries is obvious. And it's just part of who they are. And they don't even, they're actually surprised at the pushback against Mexico. And I think on the other side of the border, the pushback against the United States that you see. I mean, it's just the connection between the two countries and, you know, the food, the culture, the film, the sports connections. It's just part of who they are. It's part of their life.
Hmm. Well, for all that we've talked about, there's still so much more. We've really just scratched the surface of your extraordinarily fascinating book called Vanishing Frontiers, The Forces Driving Mexico and the United States Together, published by Public Affairs, the author Andrew Seeley. Andrew Seeley, thank you so much for writing this fascinating book, and thank you for being so generous with your time.
Thank you so much. It was great to join you.
And the time is 8:42. You're listening to the Tuesday Morning Show on WGTD-HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. Today marks the 50th anniversary of the assassination of Robert F. Kennedy. I want to replay for you, out of the Morning Show archives, a conversation recorded some years ago, actually 10 years ago, with Thurston Clark, who was looking back at that point, 40 years, back to the presidential campaign of Robert F. Kennedy in 1968. Thurston Clark's fascinating book, published by Henry Holt, is called The Last Campaign, Robert F. Kennedy and 82 Days That Inspired America. Here is a portion of our conversation recorded back in 2008.
Ahead of us talking about the nuts and bolts of the campaign and what really amounts to a day-by-day examination of those 82 days, you give some very interesting and I think perceptive comments about Robert F. Kennedy himself as a man and overall as a candidate. One comment in particular I want you to talk about is the point that you are probably not making for the first time. That is, you're not the first person maybe to say this, but you say it so directly that Robert F. Kennedy in 1968 was significantly more qualified to be president of the United States than was his brother John when he was elected back in 1960. And I had not stopped to think about that, and you take the a moment to detail for us just what in Robert F. Kennedy's background made him, for all of his youth, so well-equipped, at least in some respects, to lead our country.
Yes, JFK had been a senator for two terms, and he'd served in the House before that. Bobby Kennedy had been a senator from New York since 65, so he'd had just 3 years in the Senate. But before that, he had not only managed his brother's successful campaign for the presidency, he had served in his administration as attorney general, some believe one of the finest attorney generals the nation has ever had. He also served as a kind of assistant president. Kennedy looked for him for advice on a whole range of matters, particularly having to do with foreign affairs and the Russians. Kennedy played a key role in the Cuban Missile Crisis. He was the one who, sitting around the table, was, in the end, came down very much against a preemptive strike against the missiles in Cuba, comparing it to Pearl Harbor, saying that this country just doesn't do those kind of things. He had also more or less supervised the CIA for his brother. He'd had political experience. He'd had administrative experience. He was superbly qualified. He was only 42 years old.
Hmm.
It shows you that age doesn't, you know, age is not necessarily what's important. It's experience, and he had a lot of it.
In fact, you say he knew more about the inner workings of the government and the White House than any presidential candidate in history.
Yeah.
And you go on to say, and he ran for that office with eyes wide open, understanding the risks he was assuming and hatreds he was unleashing by becoming the second Kennedy in a decade to seek it. I mean, I guess that flies in the face of what we often think of with a youthful, idealistic candidate as being someone that just sort of boldly strode into the fray, not realizing what he was getting into. In a sense, what you're saying is Robert Kennedy knew exactly what he was getting into.
Yes, he did, and I think that there was also this uncertainty still over his brother's assassination, over who was responsible, which I don't think that Bobby Kennedy had ever entirely resolved, whether to accept the Warren report in public. He said he accepted the Warren report. There, some people feel that he had some very serious doubts about it. So he knew a lot of the dark sides of the American government. He knew about what the CIA was up to. He had authorized the attempts to assassinate Castro. As I say in the book, this man was no saint. I mean, he'd worked for Senator Joe McCarthy. He'd been a tough interrogator for the Senate's Rackets Committee in the late 1950s. He had directed assassination attempts against Fidel Castro.
Mm. And yet you say that for all that was, in a sense, led to kind of a checkered portrait of who Robert Kennedy was throughout his life, you say that during this last campaign in 1968, Robert Kennedy was at his best.
Yes.
And I think you mean that in a couple of different ways, that it brought out the best in him, but also that by 1968, he was a different man than he had been even just a few short years earlier.
Well, he was certainly, he had certainly allowed himself, you know, he had always been with his friends and in private. They had seen a kind of funny, a humorous, a gentle side to Robert Kennedy that had always been there. But by 1968, he was letting the rest of the nation see that that side of him. I mean, the facade had fallen away, in part because of his brother's assassination, because of his own experiences in the 3 years when he'd been a senator, going to poor areas in Mississippi and Indian reservations. So he had become, this side of him had come to the forefront. It's kind of a difficult thing writing about these 82 days because, as I said, he really was at his best. And you know, you get the charge of, well, you're writing a hagiography. I mean, that this is all about how great he was. Well, that's what he was. And, you know, one of the reporters for Time magazine, Hayes Gorey, wrote, I think it was before he was assassinated, maybe it was just afterwards, that the problem with covering Bobby Kennedy during the campaign was that because a lot of the reporters had become so enamored with him and thought he was so great and just what the country needed, that they were sometimes looking for things to attack him on, just to show that they were impartial. And that Gorey admitted that sometimes he crossed that line, and he would look for things that really weren't very important, just to hammer Kennedy with him, to show, hey, I'm a journalist and I'm impartial. I wanted to avoid doing that in this book. I mean, I do criticize him for a couple of things that he did, but I didn't go out on a hunt for things to prove my impartiality.
We're speaking with Thurston Clark, and we're talking about his book, The Last Campaign, Robert F. Kennedy and 82 Days That Inspired America. Briefly explain to us how running for president in 1968 was different 40 years ago from what it is now, in terms of how a typical presidential campaign would play out and what it meant for Robert Kennedy to enter the race at the point in which he did. I mean, could such a thing even happen today?
Yeah, no, everybody, he entered on March 16th, 68. Which of course, by that time this year, most of the primaries were over. A lot of them were over. But you have to remember, his brother only entered the race in the beginning of January in the year that he was running, and the reason was that the primaries just weren't as important. There weren't as many primaries. They weren't as binding. The nomination was really in the hands of the party regulars and the party bosses. And one of the reasons to run in these primaries for Kennedy was to show the bosses, such as Mayor Daley of Chicago, Mayor Richard Daley, who was the kind of boss among bosses that year, the convention was being held in his city, to show them that he had this popularity, that he could turn out white, blue-collar ethnics, African-Americans, young people, and that he was kind of playing to them. And that was the difference. Now, of course, the primaries are much more important, and also polls are much more important. Polls were very rudimentary then, and they weren't done as often.
One thing you point out, which I think is so valuable, is the chorus of voices discouraging Robert Kennedy from entering this race in 1968. I mean, important people, and people important to him.
Oh, his own brother, Ted Kennedy. Ted Sorensen, his brother's speechwriter. Kennedy, while he was making up his mind, he called them most of the people who I have trust, who I trust and I have faith in. He respected their judgment. They didn't want him to run. They told him they didn't want him to run because they were afraid that because of his well-known feud with Lyndon Johnson, the whole campaign would be seen as a matter of personal issues, not over the war in Vietnam or the racial situation in the country at the time, and that it would split the party. He wouldn't win the nomination, and it would result in Nixon beating Johnson in the fall, and the Democrats, the party's leaders, would never forgive him, and he'd be ruining his chances for 1972.
Mm-hmm.
Kennedy, on the other hand, had made such strong statements about the war and had really framed his opposition on moral terms, that the war was wrong, the bombing was wrong, that he realized that it would be impossible for him to actually support Johnson. If he didn't get into the race, he couldn't really support Johnson. If he didn't support Johnson, people were going to blame him as well. He'd really kind of painted himself into a corner on this. Also, his wife and most of his younger aides were urging him to run. Now, another reason that wasn't spoken at the time, although Ted Kennedy has more or less admitted it recently, was that they were worried that he was going to be assassinated.
Hmm. You also point out that it made very little political sense from a real practical point of view for Kennedy to challenge Johnson, in that it had not been since 1884 that a political party had refused to renominate an incumbent president. I mean,
history
was against him. I mean, in terms of any of this working out in his favor.
Right, and we still don't know if that would have happened in the case of Johnson, of course, because he withdrew on his own on March 31st, 2 weeks after Kennedy got into the campaign. So if Kennedy hadn't gotten in, I think Johnson would have stayed in the race.
Hmm. There are, of course, all kinds of striking parallels that we can draw between the situation in 1968 and the one in which we find ourselves 40 years later. I wonder if you could just point out maybe one or two of the most striking in your estimation?
Well, it's the similarity, not between necessarily the wars, but the fact that we have two unpopular wars, the unpopular war in 1968 in Vietnam and now Iraq, and in both cases an increasingly unpopular president who's waging them. And the sense among Americans that something has gone wrong. Robert Kennedy sometimes referred to the national soul. You could say that the national soul had been wounded in 68 by the inner-city riots in Vietnam, and that in 40 years later, that same soul has perhaps been wounded again by events such as the response to Hurricane Katrina and the Iraq War. And Kennedy was really the only candidate that year who understood these wounds and who promised to heal them. Hmm. And shortly after he announced his candidacy, he accused President Johnson's administration of abandoning what he called the generous impulses that are the soul of this nation, and said he was offering a way in which people themselves can lead their way back to those ideals which are the source of national strength and generosity and compassion of deed. And that's what he tried to do. And I think he understood something very important and something that I sense that Barack Obama understands. And that is that you can't heal a divided nation and heal these kind of wounds by running a very divisive and low and immoral campaign. It doesn't work. There's a connection between a campaign and a presidency. And that's something that Robert Kennedy understood because he'd managed his brother's campaign and served in his administration. And I think he understood this, particularly in the case of John F. Kennedy, the whole ask not line was set up throughout the campaign, the whole idea of sacrifice and asking Americans to sacrifice. So Bobby Kennedy understood the campaign and then the connection with the administration.
Hmm.
And I think that's very important and very important now, and I hope that Barack Obama and McCain are both going to take this to heart.
You also point out that he believed with all his heart that the campaign itself could be a force of unification and healing. I mean, that this was not just about him perhaps becoming president and then bringing the nation together.
Right.
And it's really striking, of course, in this political climate, not so much specifically Obama-McCain, but our recent political past, we don't think of political campaigns as healing events at all. I mean, if anything, they were exactly the opposite.
He saw it not only as a healing event, but he also saw it as a chance to educate the American people, to raise their moral consciousness. You know, the day after Martin Luther King was assassinated, he was flying back to Washington, sitting next to Sylvia Wright, a life reporter who had been very close to King, and she was in tears. And Kennedy usually didn't offer a lot of personal stuff about himself. He didn't speculate about himself. But I think to comfort Wright, he sat next to her, and then he started this long monologue about why he was running. And he said to her, "People think I'm wasting my time because I'm a bright man, and someone in my position shouldn't be arriving at airports and saying things like, 'It's nice to see you.'" Then he said, "But for every two or three days you waste time making speeches at rallies full of noise and balloons, there's a chance to teach people something, to tell them something they don't know because they don't have the chance to get around like I do, to take them someplace vicariously that they haven't been to show them a ghetto, an Indian reservation." And he said it was these moments that made a political campaign, despite all the banalities and the indignities, quote, worth it. Mm. And you see, again and again, he did this. He would be speaking to people in Indiana who were 1,000 miles from an Indian reservation, and he would talk about the situation on Indian reservations. He would talk to people in rural Nebraska about the situation in the inner cities. He didn't care. He wasn't tailoring his message. He wasn't pandering. He was educating.
Thurston Clark, talking about the book which was published 10 years ago called The Last Campaign, Robert F. Kennedy and 82 Days That Inspired America, published by Henry Holt and Company. Tomorrow on The Morning Show, it's Gateway Technical College President Brian Albrecht paying his monthly visit to the program, and with him will be Corey Mason, the mayor of Racine. On Thursday, I look forward to sharing with you a conversation with Mick Burke, business reporter for the Racine Journal-Times. And our primary topic will be Foxconn, a huge story, of course, which Mick Burke has been following carefully and writing about in the Journal-Times most skillfully and perceptively. And on Friday, I look forward to a conversation with Dr. Yuri Maltsev, a faculty colleague of mine from Carthage College. What prompted the visit was when Professor Maltsev mentioned how much he found interesting